So, welcome to everyone. This is the Atlas Society. I'm Scott Schiff, and this is an Ask Me Anything with Atlas Society Senior Fellow Rob Trzynski. And like I said, we do have a lot of Instagram questions. We want to encourage people to ask him anything. That's what this is about. I'm going to get started, but I would encourage people to raise their hands, and I would also encourage you to share the room. Bill, by the way, I saw you on Twitter going back and forth with one of the Orthodox fellas, and you made some really good points. Rob, let me get started with you. A lot of the questions are about, in relation to the shooting in Texas. They want to know either your position on gun control or Objectivism's position on gun control.
Okay, so you cut out there a little bit, but I assume you answered the question because you muted yourself. Objectivism position on gun control. Objectivism does have a position on gun control. I mean, Objectivism per se. Many individual objectivists have a position, but as a philosophy, it doesn't really say anything about that. Now, as a philosophy, though, it does say that, individual rights is the basis of government. And so, while we delegate the official use of force to the government, I think, you can't delegate entirely your right to self-defense to the government. You have to be able to own guns in order to be able to have the right to defend yourself in a dangerous situation. And, one of the things they do in this is, every time there's a shooting, there's an incident like this, they say, oh my God, we could have prevented these deaths. They never tally up, how many lives are saved by people being able to protect themselves, using their own weapons. Which is a real thing that happens. I mean, it happens, the last I looked, there were something like hundreds of thousands of incidents in which people will use a weapon to protect themselves, their family, their homes, etc. Right, so you have to look at it in that context. But all the other context is that when you delegate the power to use force to the government, the problem is always, who watches the watchman? That is, when you've given them all power over you, you have to then make sure the government is controlled. And one of the ways in our system, one of the ways that the government is controlled is it's not the only entity that has the ability to use force. It's not the only entity that has weapons. Now, this doesn't mean that, we're in a state of anarchy. It simply means that the power to use force is distributed through society on all different levels, including the fact that, it's distributed, there's the federal level versus the state level, and it's distributed to the fact that, you have an armed citizenry. You have citizens who are, veterans. You have citizens who have their own weapons. So you have something that's there as a counterbalance to the power of the government. And you see that in all sorts of cases around the world. People say, oh, how does this apply to anything? Well, there's all sorts of cases in the world oftentimes where you see it work the other way, where a citizenry is, I think in Venezuela a while back, saying that the citizens were disarmed through an extensive gun control regime and then, basically made utterly helpless before an extremely tyrannical government that was, so it can go out and the government forces go out and shoot people in the streets and they basically have no fear, but it's going to be able to fight back. Right, so I don't want to make too much of this, but people ignore the extent to which part of the design of a free society is to have some counterbalance to the government's use of force, so that it cannot become tyrannical. All right, so all that has to be balanced as the whole social system under which individual criminal acts will happen. But the number of people killed in mass shootings is, so one of the things people say is, oh my gosh, this is a horrible thing. It's a disease. It's an epidemic. The number of these events and the number of people killed in them is very small. It's the basic problem that you're going to have in, mass shootings is one example. There's all sorts of examples of places where, you're going to have to trade off freedom for security. when, you know, there's a trade-off between freedom and security, you know, that you could have crackdowns. Now, let's take an example of this. One of the big things that's being said to this is, well, no, the problem isn't guns. The problem is mental health. We have to have mental health efforts and red flag laws and all these things to basically to crack down on finding, on identifying and dealing with people who have mental problems. Well, that's also something that's, that is filled with all the same trade-offs as the gun control thing. Because if you're going to say, oh, well, anytime somebody's an oddball, a weirdo, anytime somebody is suspect, we think he's mentally unstable, you know, we're going to be able to do all sorts of things to intervene and to take away his civil rights. You are also creating a situation where you are, you know, in pursuit of security, you're going to be taking away people's freedoms and giving the government excessive power. And you're going to end up using that power against a whole lot of people who are just oddballs and weirdos who were or who are mentally ill, but who are harmless. And you're going to be, you know, excessively more. So the problem is, basically, you're going to be making a whole bunch of victims in order to prevent other victims from being created. So, again, when you give the government power over us, you know, the government has to have power to the law to maintain. But that power has to be limited, because if you try to create a state that's obsessed with security in every respect, and it's going to stop every possible criminal act, you end up giving that, you know, you end up creating that state itself becomes a menace to people's freedom, and it creates a whole bunch of victims in pursuit of trying to prevent us from victims. So that's my general sort of 30,000 foot view of this situation.
Yeah, that's good. I like to say that they're eventually going to say that anyone for capitalism has a mental disorder. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I definitely got into this one over on Twitter. The issue that I addressed there was whether the police had a moral obligation to go in spite of the alleged risk to their lives. My answer is absolutely yes, and that it would have had an obligation even if it was a certainty that one of them might have died. Bayer and other people who I was interacting with disagreed, let's just say. What's your take?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, one of the interesting things when you talk about the gun control debate and the issue of gun control. One of the things that always comes up is that actually the courts have actually ruled on this, that a policeman does not have any legal obligation to go come to your defense if you're being attacked. You know, and they can know that you're being attacked. They feel at all unsafe. They feel there's any risk at all to themselves. They have no obligation to actually come to your defense. And that's, of course, one of the cases for why, you know, you can't have complete gun control. Because if the idea is that, well, you armed because the police are here to defend you, well, the police actually have no option to defend you. One of the things that came out in this recent mass shooting is, you know, they had the guy cornered for like 40 minutes, and he was still killing people for like 40 minutes before they went in to attack. Now, the question is, so legally, it's actually settled as a matter of law that the policeman does not have the obligation to charge in if he believes there's some risk to himself. So then the question is there an obligation? There, I would say, an expectation. And I think definitely I'm on the side that, yes, it's morally there's an expectation that you will take some degree of risk. Now, you know, I don't think, you know, there are certain situations where if it's a high degree of risk, so if it's a near certainty you're going to get killed, I wouldn't say no. I would say you have an obligation to do it. But, you know, you have a lot of these cases, you have the fact that these people have been trained, they've signed up for it. It's like if you go into the military, right? There was, I think, during the Iraq war, there were a couple of cases of people who tried to quit the military and basically saying, well, I signed up to get education and to, you know, help me get through college. I didn't think I was actually going to be sent into a war. Well, you signed up in the military. What did you think this was about, right? So if you sign up to be a police officer, you are often signing up in order to take risks, in order to defend, in order to protect other people. That's sort of part of the job. So I think you have a moral expectation and a moral obligation, I would say, to take some degree of risk. I would say, you know, not necessarily an extremely high degree of risk. You don't, it's not to sacrifice yourself, you know, sort of recklessly. But in this, and that's sort of the disappointment, is there's been this great militarization of the police. And they have this, all this macho sort of SWAT team. I think in Uvalde, that we're in Texas, where this happened, they had this whole thing about, you know, it's a tiny little town, not very many people. And they had this whole thing about this highly trained SWAT team that they have. So I think part of what leads to people complaining about this in this case is this real macho posturing about how tough we are, and we're highly trained and we have a SWAT team. And then when the time comes to actually put that into practice, you know, it's a Potemkin thing. They're not really ready. But like I said, I don't like to try to draw super big conclusions out of these things, because these are rare events. They're rare events that happen on a regular, happen on a sort of, you know, occasional basis. It's not really an unusual thing that there's some mass killing or a serial killer or a guy sets off a bomb. I think the biggest killing actually at a school, biggest mass murder of people at a school in the United States happened like 100 years ago. A guy who set off a bomb, like a truck bomb, outside of a school because he was, you know, disgruntled for some reason. So, you know, this sort of thing sort of happens. It's part of, it's an unfortunate part of the normal risks and dangers of life. And it's a relatively small danger compared to things. That one big problem I have is people saying, oh, my kids don't feel safe in school. Or, you know, we have to have this policy implemented to totally lock down all schools and make them into fortresses and arm all the teachers. And it's a hysterical overreaction to something, you know, it's a smaller risk than, much smaller risk than getting hit, than getting in a car accident. I think it's probably a smaller risk than getting hit by lightning. It's, you know, it's a very, very small level risk. But it's something that gets blown out of proportion because it stokes certain partisan, you know, it's something that can be used for partisan ends. It can be used to promote certain legislation that people wanted for some other reason.
Good.
Go ahead. I was going to point out that the training materials that these police officers had, in fact, instructed them that in a situation like that, they were required to go in. And if they weren't willing to do so, they should seek another line of work. I mean, yeah. That's almost so I disagree with the proposition that, at least in this case, that they did not have a moral obligation to go in, even at in the event of a high risk. That's what they were paid to do. They were a SWAT team. They were not just an ordinary cop.
Yeah, and like I said, it's like signing up for the military and then saying, oh, you know, I refuse to actually be sent into war. It is what you signed up for.
I guess we go to Instagram right now.
Yeah. You thought it was a 30,000 foot view before. This could be even applied to that question from a higher view. Comments on the theory of the social contract.
That's the geosynchronous orbit view, right? The theory of the social contract, just in general. Okay, well, I actually have a lot to say about the theory of the social contract. And one of the things I've written about this not too long ago, I think, one of the things I find very interesting about Ayn Rand's approach to politics is that in a lot of ways, her approach is very Lockean, right? It's very much in step with John Locke's views on the nature of government and the role of government and all of that, except that she does away with the social contract. And it's kind of, you don't notice it because it's not there. Right, that's like noticing the dog that didn't bark. But the dog that didn't bark in Ayn Rand's political theory is no trace whatsoever of the social contract. Now, what she replaces the social... Now, let me just back up for those who are not necessarily familiar with this terminology. So the social contract is an old idea. It goes back to Thomas Hobbes in the 1600s. I think he was even earlier. Thomas Hobbes in the 1500s and John Locke in the 1600s and... There's various versions of it with Jean-Jacques Rousseau in the 18th century. And it's the idea that the basis for government is an implicit social contract in which we agree to give the government power to enforce, to use force and to enforce laws for our protection But that contract, you know, it's a two-way contract. They get certain powers that they have to use for our protection. Because they've been given those powers for our protection, there are certain limits to the government's power. That it has to, you know, there are certain things it can't do because it's here to protect us, not to rule over us, or not to be the predator themselves. Right? So this is, and there's various different versions of this. So like Thomas Hobbes, the first guy who came up with this, had the idea that, you know, you needed the Leviathan. The Leviathan is the biggest fish, the largest beast out there. So the idea is any one man, as a single individual trying to protect your rights, you are not going to be strong enough to be able to protect yourself. But if everybody bands together into a giant Leviathan, a giant beast composed of many men working together, then we're strong enough to protect ourselves and to impose social order and basically prevent there being a war of all against all, as he put it. Now, he's the one who said, though, that, you know, you basically, you have to give the government all this power, and he had relatively few limits that he put on that power. He basically said, look, you know, he basically advocated for the big Leviathan government as the devil you know, right? The devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. It's whatever evils are imposed on us by a big, powerful government are less than the evils that we would experience in the state of nature in this war of all against all. John Locke is the closest to, well, I would say, what the objectivist view is, which is that he was much more insistent, and this is the basis for United States government, it's the basis for the founding fathers, the idea that no, we gave the government power only in order to protect us, in order to protect our right, protect us animals. Our rights to life, liberty, and property are the purpose for which government was given this power, and therefore government has to be strictly limited so that it can't violate those rights itself. And then we're going to put all sorts of checks and balances, and this is the contribution of the founders, we're going to put all sorts of checks and balances and limits on government in order to make sure it doesn't overstep those bounds, and it, with some success, but not as much as we would like. Now, the problems with the social contract viewpoint, though, can be seen in the version done by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, which is basically that you give to the government, when you form a society, you basically give all power over the individual to the collective. And this became, there's various sort of collectivist versions of the social contract. And the idea is just by being a member of society, you have implicitly given society this enormous power to dictate to you about all different aspects of your life. And, you know, there's usually a fig leaf for how, well, as long as it's done democratically, it's okay, right? And it's a collectivist idea. You've given power to the collective to control the individual. And you've just signed up for this as part of the social contract. And so you'll hear people say, oh, we have a welfare state because it's part of the social contract. And the basic problem with that is, did you ever sign the social contract, right? If this is an agreement, a compact made among all the people, did you ever make that agreement? Did anybody ever ask you? Well, obviously they didn't. Now, Ayn Rand gets around this idea because, and that's the, I think that's the implicit collectivism of the social contract, is that this vague agreement that someone asserts has been made. And, you know, it's always just an assertion. It's not usually, there's usually very little basis in saying that anybody actually ever voted for it. But this vague assertion that, well, there's some agreement that has been made and you are bound to it just by simply by being there. The collective has agreed on this and you as the individual must serve the collective. There's a collectivist basis for that idea of the social contract. Like I said, the Lockean version is way better, but it's there sort of inherent in the idea. There is this potential for that collectivist interpretation. So what Ayn Rand did is she did something different. And she, I think the social contract may only make sense, not as a literal description of how society works, but as a thought experiment, basically saying, what agreement would you make if you were asked to make one, right? So it's really asking you to say, what kind of society to live in? What kind of society, what kind of social organization do I think would best allow me to thrive and pursue my values? And then, you know, that's the what you're going to come up with as your version of the social contract. So it's really just a thought experiment asking you on what terms would a society be best organized? And that's basically the version that Ayn Rand does. She doesn't do the social contract. She asks, she uses the analogy of the desert island. So this is in, I think it's the nature of government is the essay she, in which she did this. She asks you to imagine living on a desert island, you know, deserted island, you know, I don't say desert island, but living on an island by sort of Robinson Crusoe style. And how much worse off you would be, all the different things you wouldn't be able to do. You know, you wouldn't be able to benefit from other people's knowledge. You wouldn't be able to trade with them. You'd have to do everything yourself, and how much more limited you would be. And then she says, now imagine all the benefits that there are to be gained from living in a society that you have, you know, you can trade knowledge with other people. You can trade goods. You can participate in the division of labor. You can have all the benefits of plugging into this larger economic and social cooperation. And she said, but that's, your ability, the benefits you get from society depend on the idea that you are actually benefiting, that you are being able, that you are voluntarily doing this, and that the society is not being a parasite on you. And she points out, you know, a society that decides it's going to sacrifice you for the great, and she points to, you know, like Soviet Union, or living in the Soviet Union, or living in Nazi Germany, you know, being in a concentration camp is worse than being in a desert island. So the point of the desert island analogy is to say, basically, the terms on which a society is organized and the terms on which the government is established have to be such that they create results that are better off than if you than that, that leave you better off than if you were simply on your own. They have to allow for the voluntary cooperation and the freedom to pursue your own values that allows you to benefit from being in a society and working with other people. So she basically comes up with a version that doesn't require this sort of mythical social contract, but allows you to bring up the questions basically of under what terms of cooperation between people do we actually benefit versus under the terms under which you will be exploited or injured or oppressed.
That's a whole rich vein of conversation with even, collaboration versus collectivism. But I do want to bring Brian up. Brian, welcome to the stage.
Hey, I appreciate this conversation. It's very timely. I just went on vacation and got back a few days ago, and I actually took Rousseau's Social Contract with me and read it and took some notes in the margin. And there were two things that stood out to me. One, he thought of freedom in a unique way that I had not really considered, and so it seemed contradictory, and I'd like your thoughts, and then another part that I found interesting. So he basically says, from my understanding, that freedom has two different meanings or two different levels. Freedom is, on the one hand, to mean that no man should rule another. And I think he basically means slavery. And so he's basically saying that no man should be enslaved or an enslaver of other men. And so that's freedom from, you know, being owned or enslaved. But then he also says that man should be totally dependent on the government. And so I don't know how he reconciles that. I mean, I see in the book where a lot of different points he makes just seem really contradictory, and especially on those terms. I see where he's saying that, you know, the government has a right, or he thinks the government has a right to kind of impose, you know, its will for the greater good and all that stuff. But then in the – so maybe get your thoughts on that. And then the second part question I have is, In the second chapter of the first book, he says, man's first law is to watch over his own preservation. His first care he owes to himself. And as soon as he reaches the age of reason, he becomes the only judge of the best means to preserve himself. He becomes his own master. And when I read that, I showed it to my wife and my son, who has recently read Atlas Shrugged and Fountainhead. And I said, this sounds like something Ayn Rand would say, or at least a layman's, you know, version of what Ayn Rand might say. And so you're maybe, Rob, you could speak to those two questions. Or, yeah, you know, am I missing something on that first part in the way that he defines freedom? And then the second question about, you know, did Ayn Rand ever mention, you know, her alignment with what I just read from Rousseau on that second mm-hmm, part?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's really interesting stuff. Now, you have the advantage over me in that you have read that book a lot more recently than I have. So I'm going to be going from some rather old and general memories about Rousseau. So I'm not going to be able to speak, you know, the specific passages I'm not going to have at the tip of, at the tip of my tongue, so to speak. But two things. One, on that second quote, yeah, that's, I remember that second quote. That is a great quote. And it reminds us that Rousseau was coming up as part of the Enlightenment. He was one of the Enlightenment philosophers. I wouldn't say he's one of them, but he came up among the Enlightenment philosophers of the 18th century. So these were the, you know, the guys who were very influenced by Lockean Enlightenment ideas. And I think, you know, it's a similar thing that happens with Immanuel Kant, that on the one hand, he's totally undermining all those ideas. But at the same time, he also spends a lot of time kind of paying lip service to them, because that was the cultural milieu in which he lived, right? That was the cultural influence that he had on him. Now, what I think is so important here, and this has something to do with the contradictory aspect of his view of freedom, the big idea that he imported was the idea of the general good and the general will. Right. And this is the idea. So this is a major, when you use the term democracy, and I always kind of cringe at using the term democracy, because it has these two very meanings, right? Democracy means rule by the people rule. And it can have that Lockean meaning, which is to say that, you know, the government is limited in its powers and it has to answer to the people. It has to seek the consent of the governed for everything it does. And that's the sense, that's the founding father's sense of the term democracy. But there's another term, and that another version of the term democracy, and that's the version that comes from Rousseau. And that's the idea that democracy, but when the people rule not as individuals going out to vote one at a time, they rule as a collective, that the people is an entity that has a general will and a general good that's distinct from the decisions or the interests of its individual citizens, right? So government isn't just the people is not just a conglomeration of individuals. It is itself this kind of super entity that has its own will and its own interests and its own good. And the purpose of democracy then is to basically to represent the interests and the interests and views collective as against those of the individual. And then what Rousseau ends up doing in creating this concept of the general will is basically saying you are free. If you are coerced to go along with the general will, you're still free, because the general will is the will of the people, and therefore we're free because we're obeying the will of the people. Now, we all know, also, you know, from experience, and you know, it's pretty obvious that there is no, because we are just a collection of individuals, because there is no super entity that has a general will, what's generally considered to be the will of the people is really the will of some faction or interest group among the people who have, you know, pushed for and imposed a particular policy, whether that's, you know, elites in the permanent bureaucracy of Washington, D.C., or it's some faction that managed to get a goofball elected to the office of, to high office in the recent past and decided they were going to impose whatever they wanted. So, you know, it's really just you're being subjected to the will of other people, but there's this elaborate rationalization that he helped create that, no, you're not really unfree. You're not really being oppressed, because this represents the general will, the will of the people as a collective. And, you know, it's in essence, he's saying, this is what you willed without even knowing it, by means of your participation in the collective. So this is the sort of, you know, the oppressive version of quote unquote democracy, which really just means rule by whatever faction can get a hold of the government at the moment. Anyway, I think this is one of the contradiction you keep seeing pop up in Rousseau is that he has this Enlightenment element, this sort of John Locke influenced outlook that is the social environment among the philosophers that he was dealing with. So he sort of pays lip service to it while taking these ideas and kind of twisting them around. Now, I think the other thing, and I'm, like, here's where my memory's a little hazy, but I think the thing you may also be reacting to is his concept of freedom, where freedom becomes not freedom for the, what, as the founders put it, freedom for the pursuit of happiness, but rather that freedom means you have to be provided with the things that you want in life. You know, if you don't have to go out and create them for yourself, they have to be provided to you by government. And if government isn't providing you things that you need to do whatever you want, then you are oppressed. This is the modern welfare state concept of freedom, right? And again, he's taking this idea that of freedom that was commonplace and widely accepted among the Enlightenment philosophers of his age. He was paying lip service to it and then twisting it around to mean its opposite.
Yeah, even a few times in the book, he apologizes for the seeming contradictions, and he'll say something to the effect, "Now, don't question me on this, or don't press me on this, or I know this seems contradictory." So, I mean, I just read those statements, and it was clear that even he was, I think, aware of how confusing or contradictory. Even though he tried to get into detail, like what you're saying, he was saying that the general will is basically composed of the degree to which we share values among the citizens, and those, you know, let's say 75 or 80% of people who support, let's say, free speech, you know, that is the general will or the greater good, or, you know, whatever term he used.
Yeah.
And then he would acknowledge that, and we can never have 100%. You know, agreement on any value or any, you know, movement. So it was just, to me, full of contradictions.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, I think part of his thing is that he was this, you know, he and Kant are kind of maddening that way, in that they have elements of sort of Enlightenment classical liberalism put in there. But, you know, like I said, I think it's because it was next to them. It was popular at the time. It was sort of the... They're hard at work coming up with rationalizations, basically, for how we can get back to. I think he, you know, in Rousseau's case, I think he was fascinated with the idea that a tribal existence was superior to modern society. Tribal existence is, in a sense, collective, right? It's, I mean, not. Nor the, you have the tribe sitting around and their will goes, and you as the individual have nothing, no say against the will of the tribe. This very sort of primitive proto-modern or pre-modern way of doing things. And he was totally fascinated with that. And I think wanted to basically find a way within the Enlightenment context to make an argument that would make this, you know, this tribalist approach to life seem like it made sense.
If I might,
sure.
I think that this contradiction that is a universal with the philosophers of liberty and of individualism, because genetically, mankind is a both individualistic and groupish. That is, we are tribal. We sometimes move in herds, but we can also be individual, like a lone mountain lion that only meets other mountain lions for procreation. So that's in our nature. And so this is a contradiction in terms of understanding human nature and thence the laws of human nature, however you might be of their origins. So that it's individualism versus collectivism is always a problem for philosophers of human nature. That's it.
All right. So somebody responds. I think you've been on here before, and you, if I'm correct, you're the same guy. You you like to talk about genetically what we're predisposed to.
Yes, I believe in sociobiology. And, right.
So I'm super skeptical. I'm super skeptical of a lot of that. The idea that we have a genetic predisposition for this or that. I think that a lot of that can be explained simply by us observing the conditions of life. And the, one of the conditions of life is, so let's go back to what I talked about Ayn Rand talking about being on a desert, on a deserted island, right? If you're stuck on an island yourself, you are clearly in way worse position than if you are in the middle of a, you know, thriving free society, right? Where you can cooperate with other people. And so we all know to some extent that we are better off cooperating with other people, being part of a some kind of social organization. And the question basically is, so I wouldn't say it's that there's a contradiction between collectivism and individualism. I would say there's two things. There's individual thought and effort is required for everything because, you know, you have to be thinking about these questions and figuring out problems for yourselves. And we all grasp that. Or anybody who applies themselves honestly will grasp that. But at the same time, cooperation is necessary. So you have individual initiative and cooperation. Now, when you state it as individual initiative and cooperation, it doesn't sound like a contradiction. It sounds like just two things that need to be coordinated properly, right? So then it just becomes, how do we create rules of cooperation that allow for individual initiative and allow for individual dissent? I mean, that's one of the crucial things that we discovered, as in part of the modern world. One of the crucial discoveries was the hugely important role of individual. And that, you know, people being able to object and go off in different ways and do something that's outside the mainstream often leads to huge breakthroughs, new ideas. It often leads to the correction of falsehood. When the social consensus goes off the rails, those individuals out there who are dissenting from that and complaining about it and bringing up the objections are doing us all a great service. So, basically, you know, the modern liberal society, and by liberal, I mean not in that partisan 20th century sense, but in the political philosopher sense, meaning a free society. The liberal system of a free society that we've created is basically a recognition of the need for unleashing individual initiative within a cooperative system and making sure that the rules are that the individual still has the still has the ability to dissent when he wants to, while still having cooperation be possible. So I think we've kind of, you know, the interesting thing is the modern liberal society is actually a great answer to that, developed at great cost over many centuries. And so what we have to do is we have to better understand what the terms are of how you have a cooperative society that also allows for the unleashing of individual initiative and individual thinking and oftentimes dissenting opinions. So you have independence and cooperation at the same time. How do you make those sync together? And it, you know, it's doable. We know it's doable because we basically live in, to a large extent, we live, you know, even with all the faults and all the problems and the backsliding that we have, that we're always fighting against, that's essentially the society we've been living in for a couple of hundred years. So we know that a solution to that is possible. You can come up with those two things. And then it's just a matter of defining and defending how it is, what the... deserted island analogy. That, you know, you're way better off living, cooperating with other people, but at the same time, it has to be on terms that allow you as the individual to actually benefit from that cooperation and to use all the benefits of your individual judgment. By the way, I want to go farther on this idea, though, of man as a social animal, because I think that's something, it tends to be a little under-discussed in objectivism because we came out of a context, you know, the great collectivist century, the century of collectivism, the 20th century is, you know, and Ayn Rand developed her views in the context of the fight against Soviet communism, which was so thoroughly collectivist, that I want to talk a little bit about that. I don't think you need to go to sociobiology, I think, but there is a biological basis for man's existence as a social animal. And you mentioned something about how, you know, we're not like mountain lions that only meet to mate and then go off on our own way. And I think that's the crucial part of human beings, right? If you look at it, you know, if born human being, they're basically completely helpless. And the reason, and it takes them, for those of us who have kids know this, it takes them a good 18 years to become capable of actually going out and being independent and doing things on their own, right? So, and now the reason for that is biological. It's the fact that we have these giant complex brains. And it goes down to the fact that, you know, one of the theories out there is that humans basically have a gestation period of 18 months, right? But half of it happens outside the womb. And the reason for that is if you let the, you know, if the because, you know, think of a horse when it's born, you know, stumbles around for a little bit and within an hour is walking, right? And it takes a human being 9 or 10 months to learn how to walk. And basically what the upshot of this theory is that, well, actually we'd be able, if we were born 9 months later, we would be able to walk out and walk and see and all the other things that other animals can do right outside of the womb. The reason we're born 9 months earlier and so much more helpful, basically the reason why we're born essentially 9 months premature compared to a horse is because of these giant brains that we have, that if you waited for 18 months, the child would not be able to make its way out of the birth canal because its head would be so freaking big, right? So there's all sorts of weird things about humans as a species that come from the fact that we have these giant complex brains. And the upside of that for us, of course, is we get this immense survival value from being able to think creatively and solve problems and basically have a conceptual capacity. It makes it's huge survival value that just, you know, is far beyond anything the animals have. We reshape the environment everywhere human beings have gone on the earth. We have totally reshaped the environment for every other species. And so we have this huge survival value from it. But the cost of that survival value is that you have, you know, 9 months of being essentially the first nine months to a year of our life, we're completely helpless and require total care. And we have this long, long period of education. And the more sophisticated we get as a species, you know, the longer the period of education is required to obtain basically the state of the art of human knowledge that's available. So the upshot of this is that the brains that give us the power to also make us require a complex in which we are intensely cared for and in relationships motivated by love and affection for, you know, very long periods of time. So basically, emphasis that humans have on sociality, on having family, having mating structures where we, you know, we find a partner and mate for essentially for a life or for long periods of time. All of that really comes from the requirements of having these big complex brains. And so that whole trade-off of the huge benefits from cooperation combined with, though, the whole point of the benefits of cooperation is to unleash the ability of the individual mind to think. That's all sort of baked into the biology of the human being and from the fact of these big heads and big brains that we have.
I agree with everything you said, Rob. I just didn't hear anything that refuted sociobiology or environmental or evolutionary psychology.
Well, I think the problem, just to define it, and I don't know if we should necessarily argue it today, but the problem I have with evolutionary psychology is I don't see the mechanism by which these things are programmed into us. And in fact, I think it goes against what you know, these giant complex brains that have this tremendous survival value. Well, a huge part of that, they aren't pre-programmed, that they are self-programming, right? And the ability to have a reprogrammable brain, one we program ourselves and can reprogram and change, is a huge part of that survival value. So I'm highly skeptical of the idea we are somehow, and I don't think anybody's ever articulated the exact mechanism by which these things are programmed into our brains. How is it that the how is it encoded in the genes to make the brain cells? Yeah, demonstrated, and that's my reason, my skepticism for evolutionary psychology, which I know is tremendously popular right now.
I have to apologize, but I have a lousy connection here, and you're clipping out a lot, and I fear that I am also.
Is anybody else? Am I clipping out for anybody else?
No, it's me.
You clipped off for me as well.
I've got a bad signal here. I'm sitting there on a
cell phone. It's possible more than one of us does.
Yeah. All right. So I was basically saying that I'm skeptical of that evolutionary psychology has demonstrated the mechanisms by which ideas are programmed into our brains. And I think that, on the contrary, the whole point and value of the human brain is that it is self-programming and reprogrammable.
Brian,
that's
you
a
want
whole other topic for him.
To pop in with a question?
Hey, yeah. The reason I popped in was different from the Rousseau social contract. I just kind of thought it was interesting and kind of chimed in. But the original reason I came into the room was, I've been seeing some of the movies that the Daily Wire, Ben Shapiro's group is coming out with, and he is, talking about trying to, get something outside of Hollywood going, in terms of movies and programs and things like that. So I know you guys put together the Anthem novel and series and all that. And so I've been wanting for years for, someone like y'all to put together like a movie, either Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, Anthem, something that does it justice. I know the movies came out several years ago and, they weren't really all that good. But, I think maybe with Shapiro having his own studios now, it would be possible to put, something together like a 6 or 8 or 10 part series, on her two longer novels, but maybe even something with Anthem, would be a good start. I'm wondering if you guys have explored any collaboration along those lines.
Well, if anybody's done that, I wouldn't know about it. But if Jennifer can pipe in if there's something in the works. Yeah, Shapiro is a conservative, which means that he may have some interest in Ayn Rand and Atlas Shrugged, but also he's kind of on the other side on a whole bunch of the philosophical issues that relate to objectivism, right? So, he's going to be very deeply ambivalent about individualism, very deeply ambivalent about reason and rationality as the primary value, because of course he's religious and thinks we need a religious foundation for society. So I think he's among the conservatives. He's probably more likely to be on the semi-sympathetic end, but he's going to be ambiguous. So maybe he won't do it. I'm totally I love the idea, though, of people saying, instead of sitting around complaining about the mainstream media or complaining about Hollywood, that try to get money up, try to get money together, try to get funding, try to go out and do something and create something of your own. And having done a lot of thinking about how to adapt Atlas Shrugged and that sort of thing, I'm actually a huge advocate of the idea that it would be great as a miniseries. In fact, what I'd like to see would be like, take each major section of Atlas Shrugged and make it a season, so to speak, of a miniseries. And, the way they do with, these stupid, think of all the money and efforts that's been put into stupid stuff like Game of Thrones, which I am not a big fan of. They put like cinematic production values into this, and had these I'm not sure, I can't remember exactly how long the seasons were for Game of Thrones, but you have like 8 or 10 hours to put the story of one of the novels in this series. I think you could easily adapt Atlas Shrugged to be each of the three major sections is a season, and each season is like 6 or 8 or 10 episodes. I don't think it can go beyond 10 because she had 10 chapters in each section. I don't know if that would break down to 10 episodes, but it would be on that order. And I think you could be in a lot of detail and capture detail of it, which is the basic problem with, adapting Atlas Shrugged. It is actually a hugely densely packed book. A lot of stuff's going on. in it and a lot of nuance and character development. And when you try to shorten it to something shorter, you lose a lot of that. And because the theme is so different, so unusual, so not what people are expecting and not what people are sort of predisposed to understand, that I think you need that extra time to get deep into the characters and develop them gradually. And I think the great promise of doing this as a movie is that a book, by its very nature, calls on the reader to fill in all the details for himself. So if John Galt or Hank Reardon or one of these characters comes up, you're given certain descriptions of him and what he says and how he looks and all that sort of thing. But to make him fully real and concrete, you have to fill that in for yourself. And I think a lot of people, because these characters are so outside the mainstream, so outside of people's expectations, people will say, oh, I thought that character was terribly unrealistic. And I couldn't figure out how to concretize him and make him realistic. And the great value for a movie is if you had a good filmmaker who really understood these characters, that he could say, okay, let me do that for you. You know, let me cast the right person, give them the right dialogue, give the right details, get the actor to understand the character so that I can show you what this character looks like, what he sounds like. I can give you the full concrete reality of this character. And I think that, you know, that's a huge value that's to be added by making a book. So I'm hoping somebody will do that eventually, but...
Yeah, I think Shapiro is just, I've heard him, you know, talk about Ayn Rand and, you know, the way he frames it, he's sympathetic to a lot of, the arguments she makes, especially on economics. So I think he would at least be open to it. And then if he would just give, you know, the creative license to some, you know, experts.
I am available. I have many interesting ideas for that. But hopefully someday somebody will do it. But it's a matter of, like, you know, the word development exists for a reason, right? So it's the Hollywood development hell. The idea is that you have somebody has a great idea for the movie. Everybody says, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. And then 10 years go by and the movie doesn't get made because they couldn't get quite the right people and somebody disagreed on it and somebody funded it. But then he got fired by the studio and then the green light, you know, got removed. So. And this is a weird business where a lot of things that you think ought to go through don't. I mean, Netflix has been throwing money willy-nilly at funding all sorts of movies that I guess the rap against them right now is that they basically greenlit everything and made a lot of junk. And now they're getting in trouble. Now they're experiencing the problems from that. So, you know, they sort of indiscriminately funded a whole bunch of virtual productions using billions of dollars that they'd gotten in from Wall Street. And somehow nobody's decided that, hey, maybe this best-selling novel with a huge impact on the 20th century, maybe this should be something we'd do. I would hope somebody would eventually figure that out and figure out how to do it.
The U.S. Supreme Court's block booking decision wrecked Hollywood forever.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, Zack Snyder was talking about making The Fountainhead and remaking it, and he ultimately said the political climate did not exist for him to be able to do so anytime in the near future.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, that's going to be part of the problem, yeah. I have skepticism about how good Zack Snyder would be at it, but I hope somebody will try. You know, I don't want to shoot it down before it happens.
Sure. I thought the second Atlas Shrugged was, you know, underrated. I mean, the plane chase scene, I thought there were some really good moments.
I thought the second was the best of them. And I also like the fact they had a lot of actors. I mean, they weren't like huge Hollywood stars, but they were like the guys you see regularly on TV who are really good. I like their Reardon so much that I can't remember the actor's name. But, you know, he sort of plays, he shows up when a tough, grizzled old detective, right? You know, you need him on a TV show. He's the guy who shows up. I'm racking my brain trying to remember his name, but the guy they had Reardon in the second movie. And he tracked so much better with who I think Reardon is than anybody who's done. You know, he looks like a tough guy who worked his way up out of the ore mines of northern Minnesota, right? So I thought they had some good actors, and it, as general, I thought it was the it got the closest to sort of realizing the vision.
Yeah,
it's a tough novel to adapt because people aren't used to it. It's so unusual in its outlook on life that if Hollywood people like to fall back on safe standard cliches, and if you do that, you're roadkill doing Atlas Shrugged because the cliches don't work. These characters are so non-cliched and so original and so unusual.
Well, I mean, she's also the kind of special villain of certain parts of the left, and
yeah,
so
yeah.
As they've taken dominance.
Well, and when in The Fountainhead, you have the whole first scene with Rourke and Dominique that I think you'd actually have to do it somewhat differently. You have to adapt it a little bit more today. I mean, the so-called rape, quote-unquote rape scene, although it's not really a rape, but if you're explaining that it's not really a rape, you're probably in trouble, right? So I think you'd have to redo that in some way to capture the essence of it while changing the details to get you out of the Me Too hot trouble. But even that might not be enough in this current environment, because people hate Ayn Rand for reasons other than the literary qualities of her books, right? They hate her because she challenges a lot of their philosophical and political views in a very powerful way. So because they hate her, though, they're going to look for excuse they can find to say, aha, see, we told was evil.
Right. Well, let's try to get Sasson here. Thanks for joining us. Do you have a question for Rob? Are you able to unmute with the microphone button?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Oh. Greetings, y'all. I just think it's really interesting that you're talking about Hollywood and Ayn Rand, everything like that. And I'm just really happy that you guys are talking about Ayn Rand. And I just think it's really interesting about in regards to Hollywood, because Ayn Rand was part of Hollywood, right? And she was just really amazing. There's an old YouTube video of her, and I believe it's Phil Donahue. And she really puts him in his little, she really makes him pause. Also, there was another interview with her intensive eyes and her quick wit one of the newscasters back then, and it's really interesting. It's black and white. You see him actually smoking cigarettes. Yes.
Yeah, and it's sponsored by Philip Marlowe, Philip Morris. I think Philip Marlowe, William Morris. It's Philip Morris, right?
Yes.
It's sponsored by Philip Morris, the cigarette company, and the whole conversation takes place in this haze of cigarette smoke. I think it's hilarious.
Yes, and I love it though. But I mean, I don't know. I was just asked to be part of y'all to join. It's just that in regards to Robert, it's just a commentary, not really a question. It's just the thing is that Ayn Rand is very much of a thinker, right? And she's very individualism. And there's something beautiful about her work because he's masculine. What's wrong with masculinity? What's wrong with stepping out of the box and building your own and say, you know what? It is mine, and therefore I'm going to take it because it's mine. And the thing is, with Hollywood, they're just so used to did I say the right thing? Oh, if I don't, oh my God, I meant the sky is somewhat blue, not really blue. Are you gonna Me Too me? Are you gonna ban me?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like we need the cojones back, And Ayn Rand had cojones. Same thing with Margaret Thatcher. I know some of y'all may not agree with that. But it's just that where I'm coming from is this a really quick. My Naomi, my grandmother, her family was divided by the Berlin Wall. And so when I was little, I used to go to Germany and I saw West Germany, East Germany, and I would go back to the States and compare and contrast. And the thing is, Ayn Rand did a lot of compare and contrasting. And gosh darn it, Hollywood hates to use that compare and contrast. God, you have to think. You have to use your mind.
That's great. I totally agree with a lot of that. With the minute I've got left, I want to say something about
Sorry
that.
Sorry about that.
Oh, that's fine. We're just getting up to our time limit. Okay. Just one last thing before we end here, which is there's a fascinating thing that there's a lot of Hollywood people who are big Ayn Rand fans, and especially fans of The Fountainhead. And I think it's because of that theme of artistic integrity, of following your own vision. And I think there are a lot of Hollywood people who like that, or who would like to think that they that describes them, right? And in some cases, I'm skeptical about how much it really describes them. But it's in their self-flattering moments, they would like to think that they're like Howard Roark, pursuing their own independent vision. But at the same time, this goes back to the theme we had earlier about, you know, individual initiative and cooperation and trying to get those to work together. Hollywood is a hugely cooperative thing where to get anything to work, to get anything through development hell, you need to get a whole lot of people to agree with it. You get a whole lot of people to green light it. Very few things, you know, it's very hard to do anything just purely on your own because it's so resource intensive. You need so much money and so many people and such a huge crew to make a movie. So it's a place where that paradox of how do you have individual initiative and individual artistic vision within this hugely cooperative thing where everybody has to agree to help you do this, those conflicts really are intensified in Hollywood. And I think that's how you get a lot of people who are Ayn Rand fans and probably would love to make a movie, The Fountainhead, but because of that, you know, when the need for cooperation goes bad and becomes groupthink and becomes collectivist, then you have a situation where you'd love to make this movie and you can't do it because the politics are wrong.
Excellent stuff. Tomorrow at 5 p.m. Eastern, the Atlas Society asks Spencer Jacob. Then at 6:30 p.m., Professor Stephen Hicks will be back here on Clubhouse for an Ask Me Anything About Ethics. Thursday here on Clubhouse at 4 p.m. Eastern, Richard Salzman is discussing why stakeholder capitalism is fascistic. So that should be a good one. Thanks to everyone for joining us. Rob, thank you for doing this. And we'll see you all tomorrow.
Thanks, everyone.
Take care.
Thanks.